Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The Joint Commission responsible for monitoring both sides' compliance in the international agreement on Iran's nuclear program has moved forward today with its first meeting and optimism that the plan could roll out by the end of the year. The meeting brought together officials from Iran and the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the European Union one day after the so-called adoption day when the sides took their first formal steps to implement the deal. In order to get the sanctions lifted, Iran must comply with its part of the agreement. University of San Francisco scholar Stephen Zunis was asked how Tehran will react if sanctions are not lifted soon.
Given that the timing was something that was a real sticking point during much of the negotiations, the Iranians, I believe, know what to expect. There may be some quibbling at certain points about what marks the completion of the process, but I don't imagine there'll be any roadblocks or any major misunderstandings.
After today's session, Iran's nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi expressed optimism that implementation will take place by December 31st. An Eritrean migrant has died after being shot Sunday by Israeli police and beaten by an Israeli crowd who mistook him for another man that killed an Israeli soldier and killed, or rather wounded, 10 other people in a stabbing attack. The wave of Palestinian attacks on Israelis began when rumors swept through Palestinian areas that Israel was planning to take over an East Jerusalem holy site sacred to both Muslims and Jews. Human Rights Watch is calling on Ugandan authorities today to stop obstructing peaceful political gatherings. Uganda has scheduled a presidential election next year with campaign due to begin on November 9th. Ugandans have cited frequent abuse of force by police to prevent opposition campaigning. This is VOA News. Several thousand migrants remain stranded today at the Croatian-Serbian border with little food during the cold night after Hungary shut down its crossing into Croatia on Saturday. Farouk al-Hatib is a Syrian refugee.
I note that this place is not qualified, yes, to receive refugees. Okay, as you see, yes, we are in cold weather, and the place is not good. As you see, yes, the mud, and yes, the crowded. Yes, the place is also crowded here, and our message is. For the governments, yes, please, to take in consideration our suffering.
Amnesty International is also calling for European Union leaders to put the rights of refugees above concerns about protecting borders. Two people are dead and tens of thousands more displaced as the slow-moving typhoon Kopu washes over the northern Philippines. Alexander Palma is chief of the Philippines National Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Council.
We are strongly recommending this morning the forced evacuation in the Cordillera area, autonomous region, sa lahat po ng mga barangay na landslide-prone at flood-prone areas.
Weather forecasters say Kopu could dump up to 60 centimeters of rain over the Philippines in the next several days. The World Health Organization says road crashes continue to be an unacceptable risk, with a high toll, 1.25 million people dying each year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the WHO's Global Status Report on Road Safety 2015 in Geneva.
The report, which is based on data collected from 180 countries, shows road crashes are the number one cause of death among people between the ages of 15 and 29. The report also finds 90% of road traffic deaths occur in low and middle-income countries, though they have just 54% of the world's vehicles. The WHO's Etienne Krug says the highest rate of traffic deaths is in Africa, followed by the Middle East.
Africa has only 2% of the world's vehicles, but has the highest death rate on the road.
He says studies show half of deaths from injuries could be avoided if victims receive good trauma care after the crash. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Canadians go to the polls today, voting in parliamentary elections that could halt Prime Minister Stephen Harper's bid for a fourth term. Instead, we may see the election of Justin Trudeau, son of the previous leader, Pierre Trudeau. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Sometime in the last 12 months, I think it was about earlier this year in the spring, we began to understand that there was a trend of trafficking of young girls from a particular part of South Central Nigeria called Edo State.
That's Joel Milman of the International Organization for Migration. He says thousands of young Nigerian women have been trafficked to Europe this year. Details coming up.
Also, representatives of three of the world's major religions insist that the faithful are morally obligated to help refugees. And recent fighting between government forces and opposition RENAMO fighters in Mozambique is increasing the influx of asylum seekers into Malawi.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Egypt, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, bad weather is plaguing migrants and refugees massing along the borders of some European countries. Thousands of migrants survived the Aegean crossing and the passage from Turkey, but are now backed up along roadsides. Thousands are standing in mud and driving rains at Balkan borders. Busloads of people, including Syrian, Afghan, and Iraqi refugees fleeing war zones, have been stopped at the Croatian-Serbian border since Hungary closed its own borders 2 days ago. EU officials estimate this year's total of migrants and refugees to reach at least 700,000. This includes those crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa as well. Many are heading for Germany, where the government has welcomed the new arrivals. Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Turkey's leaders yesterday to ask for help with Europe's growing crisis. She offered support in speeding up Turkey's bid for visa-free access to the EU. In return, she asked Turkey to control its own borders and welcome migrants denied refugee status in Europe. Also, more than a dozen migrants drowned as Greek and Italian Coast Guard vessels rescued an estimated 900 migrants from the Mediterranean and Aegean Seas over the weekend.
As the refugee crisis continues in Europe, so does human trafficking. For example, the International Organization for Migration says there has been an alarming rise in the number of African women and girls trafficked to Italy this year. Most of them are from Nigeria. Joel Milman is a spokesman for the IOM. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the human trafficking.
We see that the number of women from Nigeria in particular that have been reported by the authorities as they register in Italy are up around 4,000 this year so far, which is four times last year's level. And at sometime in the last 12 months, I think it was about earlier this year in the spring, we began to understand that there was a trend of trafficking of young girls from a particular part of South Central Nigeria called Edo State. We identified people who said they were trafficked and had been serving in brothels in Libya, allegedly to pay off their debts to make the trip to Europe, and then were expected to remain in some kind of sexual bondage, sexual commerce in Europe after they arrived. Very reluctant to speak with the authorities, and many were under the impression that they had a voodoo or some kind of witchcraft spell cast upon them, and that if they assisted prosecutors, they would die of some kind of mysterious illness. If they were disloyal to the traffickers, that was probably the biggest obstacle that people faced trying to get them to cooperate. But I think 26 or so came under IOM's protection, and I'm not certain of where that case has gone, but that's the most dramatic thing we've heard of in this last year.
Now, were they traveling to Italy with the other migrants and refugees who were leaving Libya?
Yeah, we found them on the same boats. When they arrived, we know that many of them were told they could expect work in offices, working as secretaries and beauty parlors. You heard that too, home servants. But they come up through the same route through Libya and end up on the same kind of rafts that we're seeing rescued in the Mediterranean.
Do we know why most are coming from Nigeria?
It's got a lot of people. It's got a lot of people in the diaspora, a lot of access to overseas savings, so it helps finance these trips. We don't know particularly why this group from this one state seems to be so susceptible to this fraud, But we simply know that the numbers have gone up, as they have for a lot of countries from West Africa. In this case, as I said, four times last year's total of women.
As a result of these findings, does the IOM set up special screening procedures when it comes across African women?
I don't think we'd call them special. I mean, our attendant is certainly out, and we know what to ask and what to look for, particularly from different countries, especially if they're English speakers who are Catholic from Nigeria. We'll be looking for other things, like people who say that they had problems with Boko Haram. But if there were women who were coming from this part of Nigeria, I'm sure we would want to know whether they fit the profile of some of the trafficked women that we're acquainted with.
If you confirm that they have been trafficked, what happens next?
Well, we offer them protection, and so do the authorities in Italy, so we know that they can find a place where they'll be safe and processed, you know, without fear of falling back into the hands of the traffickers. But a lot of times the women don't want to be protected. They're either overcome by the shame of their families knowing what they've been doing, or else really believe in this witchcraft has been put upon them and are afraid to cooperate.
And what do you do if that happens?
Nothing we can do. We can't make them do anything, you know, so we have to just advise them and give them the right to make their own choices, I'm afraid. It's one of the limitations we have.
While we're on the subject of migrants and refugees coming from Libya, what is the status of that flow at this time?
Well, it's a little bit less than last year. We're about 6,000 lower than the end of September 2014, and difference between that and now. However, it's important to note that we're down about 40,000, the number of Syrians who are coming through that route, maybe 30,000 coming through that route. So therefore, when you're only down 6,000 or 7,000 and you're missing 30,000 or 40,000 Syrians, then you know that you, all the other countries combined, are running ahead of last year's total. You know, they're up around 138,000 without the Syrians. So Nigerians, Somalis, Eritreans, Sudanese, West Africans are all up higher levels than last year. So almost all the traffic has increased. Only one country, Syria, which last year was the biggest of all the senders through that route, is decreased.
And it's decreased because they're now going through Turkey?
Pretty much, yeah. That's our understanding.
Joel Millman is spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
Wars and violence in sub-Saharan Africa, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere have created the world's worst refugee crisis since World War II. European politics is playing a role in how much help should be given the migrants and refugees. Representatives of three of the world's major religions insist that the faithful are morally obligated to help. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with a rabbi, an imam, and a devout Christian about what their scriptures say about providing refuge.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is co-president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He says that refugees and exile are pervasive themes in the sacred Hebrew scriptures called the Torah.
Think about it, going back to Adam and Eve. What is the first punishment they receive for violating the commandment? They are banished from Eden. When Cain kills his brother, he is told he will wander the world.
But God also places a mark on Cain's forehead as a sign to strangers that they must not harm him.
So there is clearly a sense that when you are especially vulnerable as a refugee, you also are going to merit a special kind of protection that you are going to need precisely because you are not at home. And then you roll forward into the story of the children of Israel, and their whole story is to leave Egypt and head for the promised land. And, of course, the most repeated commandment in the entire Hebrew Bible is to remember that you were a slave in Egypt. So I think the dance of compassion toward those who are refugees is one of the oldest, most profound, and most animating stories we have in Jewish tradition, and that only got us through Genesis and Exodus.
But helping refugees is not just a biblical theme for Jews because of Jewish history.
The Jewish people have been refugees for the better part of a couple of thousand years that the larger, certainly Christian world saw as a punishment of Jews. And so we are, I would say, acutely sensitive to the experience of being refugees. But I also wouldn't want to claim that because of that experience, we are more sensitive than other people. It seems to me that just as I want to use Jewish experience to learn the greatest possible ways of being compassionate to the greatest number of people, regardless of who they are, where they are, what faith they follow. That's exactly what I hope other traditions will do as well.
Imam Al-Hajj Talib Abdul Rashid, spiritual director of New York's Mosque of the Islamic Brotherhood, says the refugee experience is also a deep theme for Muslims worldwide.
The reality of refugees, particularly refugees from religious or political oppression and repression, is one that runs to the very heart of the history of Islam.
Imam Talib is referring to Islam's early history. The Prophet Muhammad and his growing group of followers were forced to flee for their lives from Mecca to what is now the city of Medina. The Imam relates the pain of that history to a verse in the Quran dealing with righteousness.
In that verse, righteousness is defined as being charitable for people who are orphans, people who are needy, people who are stranded, people who are trying to be free from enslavement. Charity could mean a lot of things. It could mean money, it could mean food, it could mean refuge itself.
Imam Talib explains that charity's many meanings imply practical, hands-on help.
The Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood, we're right here in New York, in Harlem. So many times during the year, people just walk in off of the street who need help. Sometimes they're looking for food. Sometimes they're stranded. I mean, people will come trying to get a bus ticket back home. And, you know, one might look at the poor homeless population and see them as refugees of a sort. The response to the poor and the wayfarer, that's a prophetic response that moves across faith lines. How much do you, as a community or as a nation, embrace the prophetic value of helping those in need? It's quite a question.
It's a question that Pope Francis, spiritual leader of the world's Roman Catholics, took seriously in his September appeal to Europe concerning the refugee crisis. People biographer Paul Valéry says Francis was furious at the way many of the refugees who had survived dangerous sea voyages and overland journeys were being treated in Europe.
The basic Christian doctrine is that you should welcome the stranger, not that you should keep people out. And one way he dramatized that was by saying, well, people should take these individuals into their own home. So every Christian community, every parish, every monastery should make room for one refugee. And if that's replicated through every parish in the country and in Europe and then in the wider world, it will soften the impact of this crisis. But it will also soften people's hearts not to see refugees as a threat, but as fellow humans who need help.
Joseph Robertson agrees.
That's a huge part of a Christian faith and a huge part of my Christian faith.
Robertson is Deputy Director of Operations at Church World Service, or CWS. It's a faith-based refugee assistance arm of 37 member denominations in the United States. Since 1946, CWS has helped refugees from Europe, the Soviet Union and Poland, Cuba, the former Yugoslavia, Africa, and now Syria and Iraq. Robertson says the Bible's Book of Matthew makes clear that the infant Jesus and his family were refugees themselves.
They were fleeing Herod because Herod was going to kill the firstborn sons, and they fled to Egypt. And we always think that they had people helping them along the way. They didn't just do it by themselves.
Today, refugees can't do it by themselves either. CWS coordinates dozens of community and church-based programs where volunteers welcome refugees and smooth the path to a new life in the U.S. Robertson says these volunteers want to imitate Jesus, who championed those in need.
And we see that very clearly when Jesus got down on his hands and his knees and washed the feet of his disciples and called himself the servant, so that we are the servant of others and those in trouble and in need. It's interesting, the everyday people that feel moved to do this, they may be retired persons that have time to drive refugees around to appointments. They may be younger people who are excited about helping refugee children get acclimated to school and get started. And they're people that just simply say, Christ is calling me to do this. I'm doing this because of my faith and my willingness to help those in trouble and those in need. And in helping them, they're helping the Christ.
When the current world refugee crisis will end is not known. However, religious leaders say this much is clear. Without empathy, the means, and the political will to help, their suffering is sure to continue. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The International Organization for Migration says there has been an alarming rise in the number of African women and girls trafficked to Italy this year. And representatives of three of the world's major religions insist that the faithful are morally obliged to help refugees. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Recent fighting between government forces and opposition RENAMO fighters in Mozambique is increasing the influx of asylum seekers into Malawi. More than 150 Mozambicans have entered Malawi in recent days as the conflict over the disputed election intensifies. But their fate is in limbo as the Malawi government plans to close down the refugee camp where 140 others are living. Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre.
The Mozambicans started entering Malawi's border district of Mwanza in early July when the country hosted about 777 refugees after RENAMO fighters carried out two attacks in Tete province. The new asylum seekers are from Zogwe province, believed to be stronghold of the opposition RENAMO party. The refugees have erected makeshift shelters at Kapise 2 village, half a kilometer from Mozambique. Patrick Tuguta is responsible for the welfare of the asylum seekers at Kapise. He told VOA that more and more refugees, especially from Kondizi and Ndande areas, enter Malawi almost daily.
And who are I am Ulashinai.
He says on Thursday afternoon they received 34 people and Saturday morning they received three families. The refugees says the situation at Kapise 2 is no better than where they came from. Grace Shadrake is a mother of three children and said the refugees lack almost everything. She says there is no healthy facility around and they don't have money to buy soap. They don't have food or even salt or utensils to use. She says she's worried about how they will survive without tents during the rainy season, which starts next month. Shadrick appealed to government authorities to relocate them to the designated Luani refugee camp, where 140 refugees are being kept. But officials said they would no longer accept new refugees at the camp because of funding problems. Just last week, 30 refugees from Kapise 2 were denied access to the camp. Gift Lapozo is the district commissioner for Mwanza.
It was a position under UNHCR and government of Malawi through Home Affairs Ministry that this new batch cannot go to one camp because at the moment that camp is being closed down. So we had to send them back.
Lapozo says the fate of current camp refugees is uncertain.
We have not yet come up with a final position because this is something that the UNHCR and the Ministry of Home Affairs are trying to work out together with ourselves as the local authority.
Leader of the refugees at the Luani camp, Venice Jose Joao, told VOA that just like Kapise 2, the refugees are lacking food and facing sanitation issues from a shortage of proper toilets. The Luani camp had previously hosted Mozambicans who fled their country's 16-year civil war between 1977 and 1992. Lamech Messina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The Associated Press says a radio broadcaster calling for a peaceful secession of Nigeria's southeast has been arrested. Two Biafra separatist group says Radio Biafra director Namidi Kanu was taken into custody by Nigerian intelligence agents after he landed at Lagos Airport from London. Nigeria's Department of State Services has not commented on reports of Kanu's detention. Since June, government transmitters have tried to jam the signal of the London-based station, which is not licensed in Nigeria. Attempts to create a separate state in the 1970s led to a civil war in which more than a million Nigerians died. Groups including Radio Biafra claim the Igbo tribe is discriminated against and continue to seek independence. AP reports 11 pro-Biafra activists have been detained since last year on charges of alleged treason, which is a capital offense in Nigeria.
The World Health Organization says road traffic crashes continue to take an unacceptably high toll, with 1.25 million people dying each year from accidents, which are largely preventable. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the WHO Global Status Report on Road Safety 2015 in Geneva.
The report, which is based on data collected from 180 countries, shows the number of annual deaths from road traffic crashes is stabilizing. It considers this good news since this is occurring while the number of motor vehicles is increasing rapidly and populations are growing worldwide. But in a particularly sobering note, the data also show that road crashes are the number one cause of death among young people between the ages of 15 and 29. The World Health Organization report also finds a big gap in terms of road safety and deaths between poor and rich countries. It says 90% of road traffic deaths occur in low and middle-income countries, though they have just 54% of the world's vehicles. The head of the WHO Department of Noncommunicable Diseases, Etienne Krug, says the highest rate of traffic deaths is in Africa, followed by the Middle East.
Africa has only 2% of the world's vehicles, but has the highest death rate on the road. Some countries, such as Sweden, United Kingdom, the Netherlands, etc., have managed to decrease their road deaths rate by over 80% in the last decades by implementing a set of well-known measures. We're talking about improving legislation and enforcing it, particularly on the key risk factors such as speed, drinking and driving, the use of motorcycle helmets, seat belts, and child restraints.
Indeed, Krug says in the last 3 years, 17 countries have made progress by implementing road safety laws. He says rapid response after the crash also is important in saving lives. He says studies show half of deaths from injuries could be avoided if victims receive good trauma care after the crash. The report shows cyclists and pedestrians make up 26% of all road traffic deaths, with this figure reaching 33% in Africa. The report also finds some vehicles sold in 80% of all countries fail to meet basic safety standards. This, it says, is particularly true in the poorer countries, where nearly 50% of the 67 million new passenger cars were produced last year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The International Organization for Migration says there's been an alarming rise in the number of African women and girls trafficked to Italy this year. Representatives of three of the world's major religions insist that the faithful are morally obliged to help refugees. And recent fighting between government forces and opposition RENAMO fighters in Mozambique is increasing the influx of asylum seekers into Malawi. Coming up, we'll have music from Egypt, and in our feature segment, a Catholic priest from Eritrea is among those nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahyaus Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young. Happy Monday, Douglas.
Happy Monday, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we shall kick off with athletics tonight.
Okay.
Thank you very much. The IAAF president, Sebastian Coe, has today announced to IAAF member federations full details concerning the federation's Olympic athletics dividend. The fund will offer $25,000 every year to each national federation to assist their development. Athletics' premier position in the Olympic movement secures the IAAF the largest proportion of the revenues which the International Olympic Committee distributes to the international federations who govern the 28 sports within the Summer Olympic Games. Coe said this fund will be financed on a total of about $22 million over a four-year period, which represents approximately half of the dividend received by the IAAF from the IOC. It's meant to assist member federations in designing and implementing structured and sustainable projects to develop athletics in their countries. The idea of this dividend is to help fund projects such as those involving construction, refurbishment, or maintenance of facilities, purchase of or hire of equipment, preparation and training of athletes, coaches and team officials, including travel support, staging of national and regional competitions, and the delivery of development and talent identification programs in schools and clubs. This is the Sunny Side of Sports coming to you live from Washington. Now, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Marco Uma, who begins with women football.
Zimbabwe and South Africa have qualified to represent Africa in women's football at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. South Africa edged their hosts Equatorial Guinea 1-0 in Bata on Sunday in the return leg of their qualifier to carry the day on a 1-0 aggregate. Hosts Zimbabwe pipped Cameroon 1-0 in Harare on Sunday. With the two sides deadlocked at 2-2 on aggregate, Zimbabwe prevailed on their away goal advantage. In athletics, Kenyans Bernard Kipyego and Joyce Chepkurui triumphed in the men's and women's races at the TCS Amsterdam Marathon in the Netherlands on Sunday. Kipyego retained his title with a winning time of 2 hours 6 minutes and 19 seconds as Chepkurui completed the women's race in 2 hours 24 minutes and 11 seconds. In cricket, Uganda bounced back to beat Papua New Guinea by 9 wickets at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup qualifier in Kinara, Malaysia on Sunday. Early on Saturday, they lost by 171 runs to Nepal, and on Friday they fell by 6 wickets to the United States of America. Today, Monday, Uganda play Ireland in their last round-robin encounter. Finally, South Africa fought hard to come from behind to edge Wales 23-19 in a Rugby World Cup quarterfinals played in London, England on Saturday.
Mark Homer reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts, Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. VOAnews.com.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
The 2015 Under-17 FIFA World Cup kicked off in Chile over the weekend. Nightline Africa's Shegun on the Dota DMA in Lagos has the details.
The 16th edition of the two-yearly tournament started off on Saturday and will run through November 8th. Four African representatives are among the 24 teams featuring in the Under-17 World Cup. They are defending champion Nigeria, Guinea, Mali, and South Africa. On the opening day, two African teams, Nigeria and Guinea, tasted action, and the outcome was not bad. Nigeria started the defense of his title on a good note when it defeated the United States 2-0. Chukwu Diago grabbed the opener in the 58th minute, while Victor Osimhen completed the scoring 11 minutes later. Nigeria is on top of Group A on 3 points, followed by Croatia and Chile on 1 point each way. In the second match of the day involving an African team, Guinea managed to salvage a point when it played 1-1 with England in Group B. England took the lead in the 61st minute, and it was not until 15 minutes later that Guinea drew level, thanks to Nabi Bangura. Mali will test action later today, Sunday, when it takes on Belgium in Group D's opening game. Africa's number 4 team, South Africa, will be in action on Monday against Costa Rica in Group E. In more football news, the first round of the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup has been concluded. The qualifiers include Niger, a 6-0 aggregate winner over Somalia, Mauritania, which scored an aggregate 5-1 win over South Sudan, Namibia, a 3-2 aggregate winner over Gambia, Ethiopia, which won 3-1 on aggregate over Sao Tome and Principe, Chad, which defeated Sierra Leone on the away goal rule after the two teams deadlocked 2-2 on aggregate, and Comoros, also a winner on the away goal rule after an aggregate 1-1 deadlock against Lesotho. Others are Swaziland, Botswana, Burundi, Liberia, Madagascar, Kenya, and Tanzania. The 13 teams will join the 27 that drew a bye into the second round, making a total of 40 teams. Staying with football, the first leg of the final qualifying matches for the 2016 African Nations Championships. In Zone West B, Nigeria defeated visiting Burkina Faso 2-0 in the southern oil city of Port Harcourt, while host Niger beat Togo by the same scoreline in the capital city of Niamey. Both matches were played on Saturday. The return leg will be played in Ouagadougou next week, with the overall winner picking the tickets to the tournament finals in Rwanda next year. Let's remind our listeners that the African Nations Championship is for players in the continent's domestic leagues. Meanwhile, Burkina Faso's coach Traoré Drissa has blamed his team for the loss to Nigeria. Here is Traoré speaking through an interpreter after the match.
Bon, mon impression, je pense que nous avons joué un match.
He says that his first impression was that they played the match and they made the match so easy for Nigeria. At a point in the game, their team suffered loss of concentration and that gifted the match to Nigeria. He says even the first goal, you could clearly see that it wasn't really because the Super Eagles were playing very well, but it was simply because of miscommunication and lack of concentration in his team that gifted the goal, because we had three defenders against two strikers, but they still succeeded in scoring.
That was Burkina Faso's coach Traoré Drissa. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt. And in the Central East zone of the Nations Championship qualifiers, also on Saturday, Uganda defeated Sudan 2-0, while Burundi beat Ethiopia by the same goal margin. 16 teams, including host Rwanda, which is an automatic qualifier, will feature in the final of the 2016 African Nations Championship, which will be the fourth edition. Libya won the 2014 edition of the tournament, which was hosted by South Africa. Finally, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, says the organization is still working well in operational terms, despite the 90-day suspension of President Sepp Blatter. FIFA's acting Secretary General Marcus Kuttner made the pronouncement in a statement on Thursday. Issa Hayatou, who is interim FIFA president, agrees with Kuttner, saying the world body remains focused on its reform process and the forthcoming presidential election. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
And just before we go, in tennis, Novak Djokovic underlined his position as world number one with a dominant display to beat Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the final of the Shanghai Masters. The serve was too good for his French opponent, winning 6-2, 6-4 in 78 minutes at the Zhengzhong Stadium. It's the 28-year-old's ninth title of a season in which he has also won three of the four Grand Slams. Djokovic, who has won his last 22 sets, is unbeaten in 17 matches, dating back to the start of the U.S. Open. He has now 25 Masters titles, one more than Swiss Roger Federer, and two fewer than record holder Rafael Nadal of Spain. Djokovic now has 14,285 points in the 2015 race to London, 6,415 more than the second-placed Andy Murray, who he beat in the last four in Shanghai. In Sunday's final of the Tianjin Open, second seed Agnieszka Radwańska of Poland beat Montenegrin Danka Kozakovic 6-1, 6-2. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a Catholic priest from Eritrea among those nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. And next, low agro output in Zimbabwe has a ripple effect on the growth of the country's economy. But first, some music. Here is Abu Alif from Egypt with Basha El Sob.
بالراحة مش كده بالزمة طبعا
Abu Alif from Egypt with Bashir El Atsob.
A Catholic priest in Switzerland was among those nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Father Moussa Zarai left Eritrea as a youth and has been a champion of migrants since long before the European refugee crisis began. Father Moussa is sometimes called the patron saint of refugees. A few months ago, he even talked to another Nobel nominee, Pope Francis, about the migrant problem.
The Pope is really, he have good awareness about the refugees issue. He give big attention for this issue. So even when I meet him in last April, we talk about the situation. He remember very well because he meet many refugees, even someone from Eritrea, from Ethiopia, from Somalia. So I remember what kind of problems these people he faced during his journey, because some of them he's victim of human trafficking. So the Pope, he tried to push the international community to challenge this problem. He tried to wake up the conscience of all the world, especially for those who have the power to bring some kind of decision, so to change the policy, to give them welcome, to try how to prevent this kind of tragedies.
And so do you feel that under the leadership of Pope Francis, that priests are more encouraged to take active stances on issues of social justice?
He dropped a lot of attention. So he appealed many times about the right of these people for justice. So I think, yes, he contributed a lot for change, some mentality, some conscience. Even now, what is going now in Europe in these last 2 months, I think is even a good contribution of Pope Francis.
Are you discouraged that this refugee crisis seems to be getting worse instead of improving?
Yes, I try encourage them to start this kind of journey, but many times I hear from them ask me, okay, give us alternatives. That is when I visit last time the refugees camp in Ethiopia, I discuss with many of them. I give a conference to explain them how is danger this kind of, how can I say, travel or this kind of journey to reach Europe. But the response I receive from them is, okay, yes, we know it's a danger. We know is not the good way to reach Europe. But he asks, okay, give us alternative. What is our future here? We need to have future. We need to rebuilding our life. That is the point. So why we need to find a solution in the origin country. Otherwise, we can't stop this kind of exodus.
And your story, you know, shows that you don't have to be a world leader to make an impact. And so what would you suggest average people, including those in the Eritrean and Ethiopian diaspora, do to help migrants?
I think all these people in diaspora, he can give his contribute to change, to help in the refugees issue. I don't know now how. Because it's different situation in different place. We have a lot of problems in different area of this war with our refugees from Eritrea, from Ethiopia, from all Horn Africa. But point is, first, without unity, even those people in diaspora don't have good unity, so he can't work together, too much divided in different small groups. So it's not easy even for the diaspora to work together, to challenge, to try to deal with this problem of refugees issue.
That was Eritrean priest Father Moussa Zarai speaking with Salem Solomon of VOA's Horn of Africa service.
Some new farmers in Zimbabwe's Mazowe district of Mashonaland, Central Province, say the shortage of working capital is hampering agricultural production. VOA's Thomas Chiripasi visited the district and spent time with farmers who say low agro output has a ripple effect on the country's troubled economy.
Some of the farmers who received pieces of land in Mazowe district under the country's land reform program embarked on in 2000 say they are happy to have benefited from the agrarian reforms, adding that they are now proud owners of their ancestral land. Studio 7 spent time with newly resettled farmer Baldwin Mazango of Umsasa Farm in Mazowe, who grows a variety of crops, including maize, cucumbers, and potatoes. Mazango also rears broilers and traditional chickens, commonly known as roadrunners. Mazango says, despite occupying the property in 2008, his efforts to grow the farm are being hampered by lack of resources.
If we had the dollar before, when the government was still financing us, I tell you, these green bills, you see green everywhere. Yeah, that's the only truth, and this is not from any political point of view, but from a practical point of view.
As a result, Mazango is now appealing to foreign investors who want to seed their money in Zimbabwe to consider working with newly resettled farmers.
So if you can have someone who's productive, black or white, Chinese, Indian or Japanese, you say I have no problem. Yes, at the end of the day, I'm sure we share the same passion.
Meanwhile, the Agriculture Portfolio Secretary in the MDC formation led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, Valentine Ziswa, says new farmers should be given title deeds to access loans from financial institutions. Banks are currently not offering loans to new farmers because they do not have collateral.
And other financial institutions are owed huge amounts of money to the extent that they are not able to service serious farmers anymore, apart from the fact that some of them are facing collapse or have downsized operations.
Mazango said electricity was also contributing to low productivity on the farms because they are now failing to irrigate their crops during the current dry season.
Yeah, coffers are a bit dry, so that's where we need government to come in, you know, to at least if the fertilizer prices were to come down, the seed prices to come down, the herbicides, the pesticides to come down. Yeah, after selling, you know, I can retain a little bit of some money and work on irrigation. Oh. So that's the only way to go now. But the rainfall patterns for the past 5 years since I've been here, they are just erratic. You can't for certainly say it's going to be a good season.
On the other hand, Ziswa says farmers require frequent agricultural lessons, but bemoaned the lack of resources to finance the activities of the agricultural extension services.
There is collapse in rural infrastructure development with an inevitable decline in agricultural extension services. You find extension workers just sitting all day because they have no resources to work on. They have no resources to go into assisting people.
Meanwhile, Mazango said he was happy that many farmers in his area were now getting farming advisory services from private consultants. One of the private consultants, Jeremiah Gwanzura, tells VOA Studio 7 that their advice is that farmers should take farming as a business and not a hobby.
We are linking them within the value chain that they can connect to the market, and that the marketers can come and use their funds that are getting from the farmers and contract the farmers at the ground. That will enable our farmers to be sustainable, to be innovative, that they can grow in the product that they are producing.
Mazango, though struggling, says he's looking forward to exporting his produce and hopes to get better value for his crops.
I want this to be, you know, a medium-scale farm which exports. Not which does not stand out, but you know which shows that this program is, you know, was really worth it. Of course, with the politics going on with the European bloc, Europe won't mind.
While new farmers continue to register low agricultural output due to lack of resources, Lands Minister Douglas Mombeshora announced recently that the government was moving towards repossessing all the remaining white-owned farms to parcel them out to black Zimbabweans. The move was criticized by Ziswa and the Commercial Farmers Union. Meanwhile, First Lady Grace Mugabe, whose family grabbed a number of farms in Mazowe District, says those failing to utilize their allocated pieces of land should move off the properties.
Be honest.
People must understand this. If you are given land, you must till it.
If you can't, be honest and say that you are failing so the land can be allocated to other people who can fully utilize it. Even the fallen heroes in Mozambique will be happy when they see us using that land.
Some economic analysts say Zimbabwe's economic plunge may continue for years to come if agricultural production remains at an all-time low. Reporting for Studio 7 from Mazowe, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Angola hosted an international conference on maritime and energy security in the Gulf of Guinea from October 7th to the 9th. In an op-ed published October 8th in the Journal de Angola, U.S. Ambassador to Angola Helen Lelima wrote, "This conference is unique and especially important because it brings together public and private stakeholders from the global maritime and energy sectors and enables them to share international best practices in order to improve regional security coordination and strengthen public-private security partnerships." The Gulf of Guinea is one of the most dynamic regions in the global energy sector and is of critical importance for the economic development of much of the Atlantic coast of Africa. Revenues derived from hydrocarbons provide many African states in the region with a strong financial base to fund development initiatives. Also, many of the trade routes connecting Africa with the rest of the world pass through the Gulf of Guinea. Over the past 2 years, the states of West and Central Africa have demonstrated commitment to support and protect the development of the blue economy. The 2013 Declaration of the Heads of State and Government of Central and West African States on Maritime Safety and Security in their Common Maritime Domain, also known as the Yaoundé Code of Conduct, represents a pioneering framework to collaborate, cooperate, and share information. The conference provided an opportunity for senior officials from the Gulf of Guinea region to develop strategies to improve maritime safety and security. The focus was on interagency coordination, cooperative mechanisms between state institutions and private sector stakeholders, and preparedness for potential maritime emergencies. At the regional level, the conference was an important step in the implementation of the 2013 Yaoundé Code of Conduct. The United States, Ambassador Lelima noted, "We can and should continue to work so that the security and protection of the oceans of this beautiful continent become a reality."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.